We can move it up before they get here.
Good morning. We'll call this meeting of the Special Committee on Fisheries to order. The time is 10:02 a.m. Today is Tuesday, April 27th, 2021. Members present at this time, Speaker Stutes, Representative Story, Representative Chris Tompkins, and myself, Representative Tarr. Please let the record reflect we do have a quorum to conduct business. Good morning. Representative McCabe has just joined us. We would kindly ask members to silence cell phones while we're in our meeting. And if you need to pass a note, please use the committee aide, Thatcher Brower. A special thank you to Shannon McCain, our committee secretary, and Tom Raymond from the Juneau LIO for their support. We are still doing the remote recording of the meeting, so trying to remember to say our names for the recording secretary before we speak. Good morning, Representative Vance joined us at 10:03 a.m. We have two items on today's agenda. First is House Bill 182, Extend Fishery Resource Landing Tax Credit. And then we have a presentation, and thank you so much to the presenters for being available today. We had to change the schedule from last Thursday to today. The presentation's on the Alaska, British Columbia Transboundary Salmon Rivers Update. So looking forward to that. So first item is House Bill 182. Representative Edgman, welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you so much for scheduling House Bill 182. The bill is pretty straightforward. It essentially extends the Fisheries Resource Landing Tax Credit from its origination in 2014 to last year, when the tax credit had to expire because the legislature, of course, had a shortened session. So we're back in 2021, hoping to extend the landing tax credit from essentially today till 2030. And it's just to give the committee a little bit of a backdrop, in 1993, and in fact I was a staffer here in the building and remember the debate on the issue very clearly, sort of a whole different story, but the legislature saw that there was a ground fishing industry that was getting more prominent, that was fishing outside of Alaskan waters, the 3 mile zone, and instituted what was called a fisheries landing tax, because those vessels would come in and use shoreside facilities. And so the landing tax itself came into being at 1993, was implemented in 1994. In 2014, a tax credit program was established for the CDQ program, the six regional organizations that represent about 65 communities in Western Alaska. And it's a tax credit program that would allow a lot of those harvesters and others who fish outside the state's waters and others to actually contribute to the local CDQ organizations to help provide for funding for education, employment, and research and other nonprofit endeavors. And it's been a very successful program, and it comes to the state with no UGF dollars attached to it, of course, and I think we have a zero fiscal note attached to the bill. And so we're asking the committee to consider the legislation that would take this program, and I would go so far as to say it would have been extended last year had we had a full and complete session. We just didn't get to it. And to take the program and extend it to 2031, I think you're going to hear that there's a lot of support for the program. It's been doing really good things for all these communities in Western Alaska. It's had tremendous impact, been sort of a win-win situation. And with that, Madam Chair, that's a quick sketch of the bill and its intent, and be happy to take any questions. I've got my staff with me, Seth Whitman, and of course there's people online who can speak in more detail about the program and about the benefits of the tax credit itself.
Thank you, Representative Edgman. Any questions for the bill sponsor? Representative Chris Tompkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just first thought, it's great to see all six CDQs speaking with a common voice in the supporting materials. This might be a little bit of field, but am I right in remembering there's ongoing litigation from, is it the Amendment 80 fleet vis-a-vis the constitutionality of the fisheries landing tax right now? It's like Fisherman's Finest maybe sued.
Through the chair, Seth Witten, staff to Representative Edgman. Representative Price-Tompkins, yes, that is correct. There's currently a case in front of the Alaska Supreme Court. I'm not entirely sure when they anticipate a decision on that. That is pertaining to the landing tax and is a little over the level of this CDQ credit, though.
Got it. Follow up. Mm-hmm. So just to understand the context, if the plaintiffs were to prevail in that case, that would strike down the entirety of the landing tax, and then that would sort of render moot this tax credit program. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes, that is correct. I expect we might see legislative action if that were to happen to try to figure out, you know, how to make that tax work within whatever parameters the court established.
Great, thank you.
And just to make note, we do have Nicole Reynolds, Deputy Director of the Tax Division, and Connor Bell, Analyst, Division of Legislative Finance, online if you have any questions for those folks. And then your invited testimony, Representative Edgman, looks like Norman Van Vactor from Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation, and then Angel from EPICTA. And I don't know if we – let me know when you want to go to those folks. Let's see if we have any questions from any other committee members. Not seeing any. Should we go to one of your invited testifiers? Do you have a preference in the order?
Norm Van Vactor was first yesterday with the Senate Resources Committee, so.
Okay. Let's do that then. We can see you on Teams.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and committee members. Is my audio coming through okay?
Sure is. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. And I certainly appreciate the opportunity to be here. And again, thanks to everybody for scheduling House Bill 182, and special thanks as well to Representative Edgman and his staff for working so hard on this. In fact, with his testimony, I don't know if there's much more for me to say when he provided the background. But again, my name is Norman Van Vactor, a resident of Dillingham, Alaska, and I'm the president and CEO of the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation. We're one of six Alaska CDQ entities. And BBDC in particular represents 17 communities in the coastal portion of our region. The Community Development Program was established under the Hickel administration in 1992 and codified in the Magnuson-Stevens Act in 1996. We really think it's a remarkable program, and it provides Alaska's coastal communities along the Bering Sea specific harvest quotas in the Federal Water Fisheries, or the EEZ. The benefits of harvesting this quota are invested and reinvested in fisheries development, regional development programs, and provide employment and educational opportunities to our community's residents. The Alaska Legislature enacted the Fisheries Resource Landing Tax, as you heard, in 1993, and the CDQ tax credit provision was enacted in 2014. Our for-profit fishing partners that we partner with that harvest our CDQ quota are eligible to participate in the tax credit program and in return, redistribute those funds to us. The legislature considered extending the sunset provision last session in Senate Bill 184, as I believe. Unfortunately, this bill, along with many other bills, failed to advance as a result of the chaos, if you will, caused by the coronavirus. Principally, BBDC relies upon the Fisheries Resource Tax Credit Program to supplement the funds that we provide to the Bristol Bay Science and Research Institute to do all their collaborative work with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game under an MOU. Our efforts are critical in providing stable research funding that directly benefits the state, the region, and ultimately the health of the salmon resource, and really, we feel, strongly improves the economic yield that the annual harvest provides for all Alaskans in the fishery, and the Bristol Bay salmon fishery in particular. Extending this program through 2030, as has been discussed, would provide stability for our long-term planning in the region and would further solidify our collaborative work that we do with the Department of Fish and Game. Again, we thank you for your time and consideration. And if we can provide any additional information, we'd be happy to do that. Good morning.
Thank you very much, Mr. Van Vactor. Any questions for the presenter? Okay, I'm not seeing any. Thank you. I hope you can stay online in case any come up. Thank you. And then Angel Strumnica, if I'm saying it correctly, is next. And I'm not sure if that's on the phone or on Teams.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm on the phone.
Great. Wonderful. Welcome. If you wouldn't mind stating your name and affiliation for the record, we would love to hear your testimony.
Great. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the House Fisheries Committee. For the record, my name is Angel Drapika. I appreciate the opportunity to provide some brief comments today on behalf of the Aleutian Pribilof Island Community Development Association, more commonly known as APICDA. We represent six very remote cultural communities in Southwest Alaska, and we are one of six CDQ organizations whose mission is to increase direct participation in Bering Sea and Aleutian Island fisheries and to help develop sustainable fisheries-based economies. Our organization utilizes the revenue generated from our quota holdings and fisheries investments to create jobs, build infrastructure, provide scholarships and workforce training, and help support a wide range of local priority initiatives and projects through grant programs to eligible community entities. I'd echo Norm's words of affinity towards this remarkable program and its crafters on the state and federal levels. We strongly support HB 182 and the continuation of the Resource Lending Tax Credit Program. Under the program, our harvest partners are providing an opportunity to attribute a portion of their landing tax liability from the harvest of our CQ quota for specific fisheries investments identified in statute. This has been a very meaningful program that we've used to advance our mission through supporting training opportunities directed at employment in the seafood industry and to help with shoreside facility improvements. We greatly appreciate Representative Edgman's sponsorship of this bill and the work and consideration of the committee and your staff. In addition, the representative from Central Bering Sea Fishermen's Association, the CDQ group for St. Paul Island, was unable to make the hearing due to a conflict today and requested that I share CBSFA's strong support of the on the record for this bill as well. Thank you. And I'm happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you so much. Appreciate your testimony this morning. Any questions for our testifier? Okay, not seeing any. And could you just repeat, you said the Central Bering Sea Fishermen's Association, you're also speaking on their behalf as well, right?
That's correct.
Okay. So that's half of the CDQ groups that we've heard from this morning. So that's really helpful. Thank you.
And I'd note a letter that was also submitted on behalf of all six.
I do believe we have that in our packets as well. Thank you for that reminder. Okay, not seeing any questions for the testifier. Again, that we have Nicole Reynolds, Deputy Director from the Tax Division, and Connor Bell, Analyst with Division of Legislative Finance. Any questions for those folks? Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Chair Tarr. So I am interested in talking to Mr. Bell, I think. The question is for him, and I'm interested in the fiscal note and how this works as far as DGF. I'm understanding that a portion of this is not DGF and a portion of it is DGF and sweepable, non-sweepable. I'm interested in how that all works. Maybe Mr. Bell could tell us if this is the municipality's part of this or the CDQ's part of this is sweepable if I'm reading this right.
Mr. Bell?
Thank you. Through the chair, this is Connor Bell with Legislative Finance. So first, let me note that this is not a standard rule for Legislative Finance Division. We're not generally in the business of providing recommendations, but this is required by statute. And so basically, we do recommend continuation or of this provision based on it being not affecting state revenues. It's those revenues are separate and shared with the it is the municipal share that is the credit is taken against based on AS 4377050. So therefore, basically our recommendation is based on only the municipal share portion of the revenue being affected, and the tax division will be able to speak to this in more detail. I'm not familiar with what aspects are sweepable.
Okay, and so, Mr. Bell, just in summary, what you're saying is you can give the positive recommendation for this because the tax credit is used against the municipal revenue portion of the revenue for this?
Madam Chair, that is correct. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Bell? Okay. Do we want to try Deputy Director Reynolds and see on your second point about sort of sweepable funds?
Maybe Representative Edgman has an idea. I'm just trying to understand where it all fits. So, or the deputy director is fine too.
Okay.
Whoever might know. I'm already sort of checking with my staff, but.
Okay.
Thanks.
Deputy Director Reynolds, do you have anything to add on that point?
Good morning. For the record, this is Nicole Reynolds, Deputy Director of the Tax Division at Department of Revenue. So to answer the question, the CDQ credit can only be used against the municipal share of the fisheries resource landing tax revenues. So the state share of the proceeds are reported in the unrestricted general fund, the UGS, and those revenues would remain the same. The municipal share of the proceeds are reported in the designated general fund, DGF, which would be reduced by the CDQ credit, and those amounts are reflected in Department of Revenue's fiscal note.
Any follow-up, Representative McCabe?
No, thanks.
Thank you. And just for my knowledge, then, Deputy Director Reynolds, because this has become sort of a bigger part of the conversations now, you know, this wouldn't be in the category of funds that are considered sweepable if the revenue, you know, the state portion anyhow, comes in as unrestricted general fund.
I believe that's correct. I'm not entirely familiar with the term sweepable or not, but the funds in the designated general fund, those are what are shared with the municipalities, and so what we report there in our annual report, those numbers would be reduced, but the unrestricted general fund numbers would not be reduced.
Got it. Representative Edgman, anything to add?
Yes, Madam Chair. It's my understanding that these monies would not be sweepable in the same way, or they wouldn't be sweepable, period, given that the funds, the Alaska Marine Highway funds, the Violent Compensation Boards funds, and all of the 30, 40 or so of those separate sort of statutory driven entities that are sweepable, this is different because the money flows through the Department of Revenue and not through like a board or something that actually does something in statute.
Thank you, Representative Edgman. I think that was consistent with what I was thinking too, and glad to have that clarity. Any comments? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question is for the maker of the bill. Obviously, my concern is that we're reducing the municipal contribution, the money going to the municipalities, but the money's still there. It's essentially a trade. Mm-hmm. And can you speak to what the added benefit of that looks like? Because obviously the municipalities could use this funding, but it's being utilized in a different way. Can you talk about that relationship?
Yes, through the chair. So the tax credit's been in place since 2014 with a one-year stand-down because of the legislature's inability to finish its work last year. And as we've researched the bill, there's been no opposition from municipalities saying, hey, we'd like to have this money redirected back to us or anything like that. And in terms of the benefits to the CDQ program itself, you know, there's six regional organizations, communities from Acutan all the way up to Brevig Mission and in between and so forth that receive a lot of benefits from the proceeds of this tax credit. In some years, north of $600,000. But it's money that goes towards educational opportunities, research, BBDC. Mr. Van Vactor could speak at length about the Bristol Bay Science and Research Institute, which does a lot of research-related activities in conjunction with the Department of Fish and Game in the Bristol Bay region. So there's definitely a broader good attached to the tax credit that, I'm not going to say it supplants municipal activities or anything like that, but also contributes to the wealth of the communities, the regions, the entire sort of swath of Western Alaska that participates in the CDQ program. And again, we haven't inquired or haven't encountered any opposition to it.
Thank you.
And Representative Vance, I see Mr. Van Vactor. Perhaps you had something you wanted to add to that as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I just wanted to say that, like in our case, on any given year, the number might actually be anywhere from $80,000 to $130,000. But we turn that into a lot more. We'll turn that into $600,000 that will contribute directly towards our Science and Research Institute. We use share matching and fundraising with our Pollock partners, who contributed last year over $400,000 to education programs in the region. So it's seed money that just goes an awful, awful long way.
Would it be accurate to think of it as sort of allowing you to leverage other funds and then be more strategic in those investments?
Exactly.
Thank you. Any other questions? Any other questions or comments? Okay. I am going to go to public testimony then. We have on the line here Jennifer Williams from Yukon Delta Fisheries Development Association.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the House Fisheries Committee, thank you for scheduling House Bill 182. I'd also like to express thanks to Representative Bryce Edgman sponsoring the bill and to Seth Whitten for his staff support. My name is Jennifer Williams, a lifelong Alaskan. Also, originally from Emonic, which is in the lower Yukon region, and I'm currently employed with Yukon Delta Fisheries Development Association as the government affairs. YDFDA is the CDQ entity representing six communities on the Yukon River Delta, and our member communities represent more than 3,400 residents who live in one of the most, economically challenged regions of the United States. So the CDQ program allows to provide fishery and economic benefits to our resident fishermen and, their families and the entire region. YDFDA has participated in the Fishery Resource Landing Tax Credit Program since its inception. And we use this program to partially offset the amounts we spend annually to support fishery research and monitoring studies on the Yukon River. This research is undertaken and developed in collaboration with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. The credits, that greatly assisted our test fishing monitoring activities on the lower Yukon for the Chinook, the summer, and the fall chum species, and also conduct lamprey eel tagging and recovery studies. Importantly, conduct Chinook out-migration and small trawl survey studies sponsored in part by NOAA. Both subsistence and commercial openings are predicted on the test fishery results. Without this valuable information, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game would be hard-pressed in our management efforts, which would likely result in a loss of economic opportunity in the region and a request for additional state dollars. So none of the tax credits are used for YDFDA administration or management fee surcharge. The Fisheries Resource Tax Credit Program is a great benefit to the residents of Western Alaska and the state of Alaska. We urge your support for House Bill 182. Thank you for your consideration and your support. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much, Ms. Williams. We appreciate your testimony this morning. Any questions for our testifier? Okay, not seeing any. Thank you again for joining us. I don't see anyone else online, and I don't see anyone in the room. Go ahead and close public testimony. Any other comments from the bill sponsor or your staff?
Yes, Madam Co-Chair, pardon me. I just wanted to make the point that, the Fisheries Committee also serves, of course, as a budget subcommittee for the Department of Fish and Game, and it's interesting that I think as this program hopefully gets ratified and continues, we saw just a few weeks ago when we had the department's budget in front of us that the UGF portion, the state funding in the department, is I think it's at 52% right now, but it's a number that's going lower and lower as additional funds are supplanting the need for state monies, and this tax credit program is one of those. The BBSRI program that Mr. Van Vactor talked about is very unique because it does allow for some of the proceeds from this program to actually supplant what the Department of Fish and Game would normally provide for or enhance what the department is able to do with existing state money. So the role of this program, that the tax credit itself, not only has sort of local benefits in terms of all of the above that we talked about earlier, but also in the larger context of helping the department get its work done.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Just going to take a brief at ease. We're back on the record, and we just wanted to check in and see if any committee members had additional questions. We've had a really thorough presentation and heard from half of the interested CDQ groups in strong support, and we have a letter from all of them in strong support. So at this time, it sounds like all the committee members are comfortable with moving this piece of legislation on to its next committee of referral, the Finance Committee, so there's additional time for review if anybody had a question come up. But with that, I would entertain a motion.
I would be happy to do that, Madam Chair. I move House Bill 182, version 32-LS0826/A from committee with attached fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Okay, seeing no objection, we will move this bill along. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. We are back on the record and really looking forward to the presentations we have coming up. We are calling this the Alaska British Columbia Transboundary Salmon Rivers Update. We have five invited testifiers. Some of them have provided us with a presentation, but not all, and so we'll try to make note of that. I'll say all of the names first, and then we'll start on our list. First, Bree Walker from Salmon Beyond Borders, and then Chris Sargent from University of Montana Research, Flathead Lake Biological Research Station. Then we have Raymond Paddock, who's an environmental coordinator with Central Council Tlingit and Haida. And then Tis Peterman, Special Projects Consultant, Southeast Alaska Indigenous Transboundary Commission. And then Francis Leach, the Executive Director, United Fishermen of Alaska. And we are going to start with Bree, and she does have a presentation, and it's the one that's loaded on the screen there. And I have to step out to take a phone call, and I'm going to hand over the gavel to Speaker Stutz, and I will be right back. But Bree, please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Omintar and members of the committee, and thank you for the invitation to speak here today. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you just great. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you, Speaker Stutz. My name is Bree Walker. I am the campaign coordinator for Salmon Beyond Borders, and I'm joining you this morning from Occoquan and Singanani, the ancestral and present homelands of the Occoquan Tlingit people in Juneau, Alaska. Salmon Beyond Borders is a community-driven campaign. We work closely with commercial and sport fishermen, community leaders, tourism and recreation business owners, and concerned citizens in collaboration with tribes and First Nations, united across the Alaska-British Columbia border to defend and sustain our transboundary rivers, jobs, and our salmon way of life. Next slide, please, Thatcher, or whoever is changing the slides. As many of you know, the Taku, Stikine, and Unik are world-class transboundary salmon rivers that originate in northwest British Columbia and flow into southeast Alaska. These iconic salmon rivers have been centers of culture, commerce, and biodiversity for thousands of years. At the headwaters of these major river systems, the British Columbia government has more than a dozen large-scale open-pit mines in various stages, from abandonment to exploration and development to full operation. The industrialization at the headwaters of these rivers is the largest threat to some of the last remaining wild salmon habitat left on the planet. And British Columbia's archaic mining laws are not strong enough to protect water quality, wild salmon, and the communities that rely on them. Next slide, please. For many years, starting in 1998, elected Alaskan lawmakers, including former governors, dozens of municipalities throughout Southeast Alaska, and the Alaska Congressional Delegation, along with 15 federally recognized tribes in Southeast Alaska, hundreds of business owners, tour operators, commercial and sport fishing groups, and thousands of individual Alaskans have called for enforceable protections and robust financial assurance in these transboundary watersheds. Members of this committee, including Madam Speaker Stutz, Chairwoman Tarr, Representative Ortez, Representative Christ Tompkins, and Representative Story, along with other members of the Alaska legislature, have been and continue to be leaders on this issue. Thank you for your continued efforts and support. Today, we have continued support from the Alaska Congressional Delegation, including a 2019 letter from Senators Murkowski and Sullivan, and the six U.S. Senators from Washington, Idaho, and Montana to Premier Horgan in the province of British Columbia. Additionally, Senator Murkowski continues to lead on federal appropriations for water quality monitoring and U.S.-BC transboundary watersheds. Most recently, U.S. Congress appropriated almost $4 million for this work in fiscal year 2021. It is important to note that this funding for water quality monitoring does not just focus on Alaska, British Columbia watersheds, but also includes Washington, Idaho, and Montana as well. And just earlier this month, Salmon Beyond Borders co-hosted a briefing with Congressman Young and the Wild Salmon Caucus on the need for financial assurance in our transboundary salmon rivers. And yet, despite all of these important steps forward, I'm here today with a sense of urgency. Next slide, please. The Taku, Stikine, and Unik are some of the world's last intact wild salmon rivers. Collectively, they have historically produced 80% of the king salmon in Southeast Alaska. Yet this year, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game is set to add the Taku, and Stikine Chinook to the growing list of stocks of concern, which already includes the Unic River Chinook. And the Stikine River sockeye runs are forecasted to not meet subsistent needs this season. Meanwhile, in British Columbia, we are seeing the mining projects near the headwaters of these critical salmon rivers move ahead at a faster rate than they have in previous years. And few substantive changes have been made to BC's mining regulation and permitting policies following the 2014 Mount Polley waste dam failure, despite recommendations from their own Auditor General. BC has still not amended its mine reclamation policy for mines throughout the province, including mines in transboundary watersheds, despite former Governor Walker specifically requesting that, at minimum, BC require mining companies to post a full reclamation bond at permitting, just as Alaska requires. Next slide, please. This is most clear at the headwaters of the Stikine River, where some of the largest mining companies in the world are buying claims and projects from the smaller junior developers. This map that you're looking at highlights the sheer number of potential mines near the Stikine headwaters, in addition to the operational Red Chris mine. Specifically, almost the entire riparian corridor of the Iskut River, which is the largest tributary of the Stikine, is staked for mining claims. Next slide, please. It is important to note that the size and scale of these mines and their mine waste dams, which are meant to last in perpetuity, are significantly increasing in size, as shown here. And again, the expert panel that reviewed the Mount Polley mine waste dam failure, which spilled 6.6 billion gallons of mining waste, found that BC could face an average of 2 dam failures every 10 years under the business as usual conditions. The 3 middle tailings dams displayed in the visual you're looking at are the Red Chris, Shaft Creek, and Galore Creek tailings dam heights. All of these are within the Stikine watershed. Cumulative impacts and years of concern expressed downstream are being ignored as BC continues the mass industrialization of our shared salmon watersheds. You'll hear more about this from my fellow presenters today. Next slide. On a personal note, it has been a deep honor for me to get to know the people whose lives are directly tied to these rivers on both sides of the border throughout my work with Salmon Beyond Borders. I do hope to convey to you that the Taku, Stikine, and Unic are more than just wild salmon rivers. These are living salmon-human river systems where salmon and people are interconnected. Salmon Beyond Borders, along with our partners throughout the region, continues work to elevate this issue at the federal level. We need the state of Alaska to support both a state and provincial process, but also a federal process that brings everyone, all relevant jurisdictions, including and especially the tribes, to the table to establish enforceable protections for our shared transboundary salmon rivers. I'm grateful for the opportunity to speak to you all today. Thank you, Chairwoman Tarr and members of the committee, for your time and attention to this important issue and for inviting the fellow presenters' testimonies.
Thank you very much, Ms. Walker. Do we have any questions from this committee for Ms. Walker? Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Vice Chair Stute. Through the chair, Ms. Walker, I'm curious of a couple things. So 6 years later, can you describe for us the effects that the Mount Polley collapse of the Mount Polley earthen dam to prevent or to hold back tailings, how it's affected the salmon in the area that it is located? And also, I'm sort of interested in what you say mining waste. I'm interested in what's in the mining waste itself.
Certainly. So there are certain things that I can speak to, and then there are certain things that perhaps one of the following presenters could address. In terms of what has happened in the wake of the Mount Polley disaster, I'm not a fisheries biologist, I'm not a hydrologist, so I will not speak as one, and I would be happy to connect you with resources from people who are in the community, on the ground, as to what they are seeing. But what I can say is that, you know, again, the Mount Polley tailings dam failure is a notion, this is an example of how the mining industry in British Columbia is enforced and regulated. And it certainly has not been to the benefit of human health and the environment. The company, Imperial Metals, has not been held accountable. And in fact, they've been permitted to discharge more wastewater into Quesnel Lake. So there was a expert panel that looked into the Mount Polly tailings dam failure. There were a number of recommendations that came out of that disaster, and yet we have yet to see British Columbia change those rules and regulations to reduce risks to communities and watersheds. To address some of your other questions, I'd be happy to share resources with you after the meeting.
Thank you, Ms. Walker.
Follow-up? That'd be great. I appreciate it. I think what I'm suffering from is a difference in types of tailings. I grew up in northern Minnesota, and I used to swim in the tailings ponds. And look at me. So, but point is I think there's all sorts of different tailings and tailings ponds, and some of them are toxic, some of them are not. We've had 6 years now to study Mount Polly, and I'm interested, really interested, to see how it's affected us and the lake and the fish and that sort of stuff. I suspect it's had a huge impact, but I just kind of like to know for reference. So thanks.
Thank you. Are there any further questions? Representative Story.
Thank you, Vice Chair Stutz, and more of a comment, and that is just thank you for your efforts on this and keeping our attention to this as well as on the federal level. As we know, our wild salmon are so important to us, and I just appreciate everyone, tribes, all the groups coming together on this. So thank you.
And thank you very much for taking your time to testify before our committee, Ms. Walker. We appreciate it. And next up, we will go to Chris Sargent, who is from the University of Montana Research at Flathead Lake Biological Station. Mr. Sargent?
Thank you. Is my audio coming across okay?
It's coming across loud and clear. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Oops. Well, it was coming across loud and clear. Hold on. Looks like we have a little technical difficulty. Could we take a brief at ease? Back on record. We have lost Mr. Sargent temporarily, so we will go to Raymond Paddock, the environmental coordinator from the Central Council Tlingit and Haida.
Okay, I think I made it back.
Chris is back.
Is that Chris? Oh, okay, Chris.
I don't know if I bumped a button or something, just that I've been removed from the meeting. I didn't know my slides were that bad right off the bat. I'm sorry.
Perfect. Thank you. We're happy to have you back.
Okay, thank you. I'll try again. Thank you, Madam Speaker, and members of the committee for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Chris Sargent. For the record, I'm a research scientist with the University of Montana's Flathead Lake Biological Station. I reside in Seattle, Washington, and recently moved here after spending about 10 years in Juneau, and I study rivers and salmon in this transboundary region. The good news in the transboundary region shared by Alaska, British Columbia, and Indigenous governments is that they're still thriving watersheds. But they've reached a point where cautious management and monitoring of their health is a necessity, and I hope I can inspire a little more action in that direction. Almost 2 years ago to the day, I spoke on this same topic to this committee, and the basic message remains the same. There are many mines in the transboundary watersheds, like Bree pointed out, in various forms of abandonment, exploration, and operation. And we need to continue to improve the quality and coordination of environmental monitoring on both sides of the border. Next slide, please. After my first testimony of this committee in 2019, I contributed to a 22-author letter published in the journal Science involving Canadian and U.S. experts in science and policy. In that letter, we agreed that 1, mine assessments underestimate risk, 2, mine permitting often relies on environmental mitigation, such as water quality treatment facilities, that lack verification in the real world and the field conditions. And 3, there's a need for increased, independent, transparent, and peer-reviewed science. And I would add, the need for more voices at the table where decisions are made on how to treat these watersheds. Next slide, please. These These three points from that paper are critically important for the transboundary region, which includes the Taku, Stikine, and Unic rivers, shown here. The points represent key mines that continue to be in various phases of operational exploration, and several are proposed to be large open pit operations, which remove large amounts of earth to extract very small amounts of target metals like gold or copper. The next two slides will illustrate just how much earth needs to be removed to extract low-grade ore reserves. Next slide, please. A common grade of gold for open pit operations in this region requires removing around 2,200 pounds of rock for 0.02 ounces of gold. This is about the same weight as the 20-foot aluminum fishing boat pictured here. Next slide, please. To get the gold in my wedding ring, it would require moving over 23,000 pounds, or 10 2/3 fishing boats, of earth. So these projects move massive amounts of earth for very tiny amounts of metals. While that might be economically feasible for a mining company, this involves a large environmental trade-off. One critical component to tracking these trade-offs is the adequate monitoring of watershed health before, during, and after project operations to see how the water, land, and animals change in response to these large disturbances. Next slide, please. There's currently one open pit mine actively operating in transboundary watersheds. In the blown up box to the right, I show a heavily staked area of the Stikine River watershed where the colors represent mineral claim ownership by several different companies. The yellow cross toward the right shows the Red Chris mine, a large open pit mining operation that has been in production since 2015. Next slide, please. We can use satellite imagery to watch how quickly the land transforms once an open pit project begins. Here is the land around Red Chris Mine before full-scale construction started. Next slide, please. Construction of the project began in 2012, and we can begin to see some clearing in the land. Next slide, please. Regular production began June 2015, and all of the major pieces of the project are in place. Next slide, please. In 2020, 5 years after production began, we can see the open pits that will eventually converge into one, and we can see the growing mine waste storage reservoirs, also known as tailings storage facilities. The main dams holding back these tailings have a Canadian Dam Association consequence classification of very high, meaning that a failure would result in significant loss or deterioration of critical fish or wildlife habitat, where restoration or compensation in kind is possible but impractical. The series of images demonstrates how quickly habitat within a watershed can change and illuminates the point that we need to start early in the process to collect environmental monitoring data before the operations are built. Next slide, please. In response to the large number of operating and exploratory mines in the transboundary region, a number of government entities have conducted monitoring. Last year, I conducted an independent data review of government-led monitoring in transboundary watersheds, and while each of these are really important pieces of work, I concluded that monitoring efforts tend to be concentrated in small areas of each watershed, or relatively short-term in effort. Therefore, monitoring the environmental health of the transboundary region will require commitment to longer-term data collection across a broader number of sites than currently exists. And when I say longer term, I mean at least 5 years of consistent and coordinated monitoring. 10 years is better. These time periods are well established for many types of monitoring programs. For example, Section 7 of the Alaska Highway Drainage Manual recognizes the importance of long-term stream flow data collection when designing infrastructure like bridges and culverts, stating, a complete discharge record is usually defined as one having at least 10 years of continuous record. 25 years of record is considered optimal. The recently completed joint effort of Alaska DEC and BC Ministry of the Environment, while an important start for monitoring, only spans a period of 2 years, and much more information is needed to accurately assess the current baseline health of transboundary watersheds. Next slide, please. So, what would a more comprehensive environmental monitoring program look like on the ground? In this slide, I want to show that monitoring in the transboundary watersheds needs to answer two questions at the same time. First, how is the overall condition of the watershed changing over time? This helps see how factors unrelated to mining impacts, such as glacier retreat, changing rain patterns, and warming water temperatures, change the chemical, biological, and physical aspects of the overall watershed. Monitoring practitioners typically do this by laying grid over the watershed and choosing some random set of points, but many different approaches are available. In question two, at the same time, how does a particular mine impact a watershed? This involves targeted, non-random points placed at different distances from the mine to see how the river is affected. To date, no monitoring efforts in transboundary watersheds have been designed to answer both of these questions. Next slide, please. And consistency is key. The way in which we collect data at each place in the watershed is absolutely critical. Just because we measured something like pH or the amount of copper in the same river at two different times doesn't necessarily mean those two points are comparable. Many things influence our measurements, including flow level, time of day, or season. So this means that monitoring needs to keep these factors as similar as possible across all measurements, or we need to collect many, many measurements that span all the ranges of environmental conditions. Next slide, please. For example, many toxic metals are found in higher concentrations in the water during low flow periods. So if you only collect water during higher river flows, you may miss the periods when there are more metals in the water and therefore more toxic to fish and other aquatic organisms. Many monitoring programs don't cover this aspect of sampling, and in many watersheds, we don't even have sufficient flow information to examine these differences. Next slide, please. I've got two more and I'm all done. This brief example helps illustrate the scale and complexity of monitoring transboundary watersheds and leads into my take-home message. As part of a focused environmental monitoring program, I work alongside Taku River Tlingit First Nation staff in Atlin, BC to monitor water sediment, fish and insects in the Tulsiqua River, the largest tributary to the Taku River, and the location of Tulsiqua Chief Mine. I just want to be clear that the views I express are my own, don't represent TRTFN. Over the past 2 years, TRTFN has monitored 12 to 17 sites in about a 6-mile stretch of river. This is a much higher density of sites than any other effort taking place in transboundary watersheds. Despite this, and due to broad-scale forces such as glacier retreat or large floods, we still need several more years of data to really understand what is driving the biological and chemical patterns in our collected data. Next slide, please. So in my last slide here, that red box represents the area of the map I just showed in the Tulsiqua River and how small it is compared to the rest of the Taku River watershed. My take-home message is, considering the complexity of interpreting water quality patterns in this small section of watershed, the level of effort needed to characterize an entire watershed requires long-term funding commitment and strong collaboration across all governments, where all parties agree to the monitoring program goals, objectives, and scientific approach. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sargent. Are there any questions? Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Vice Chair Stutes. So early on in your slides, where the questions were 1, 2, 3, you mentioned more voices at the table. Could you expound on that a little bit? What voices? Who are you thinking specifically would be helpful in sort of mitigating the issue?
Yeah, you know, I would leave that up to a lot of the folks. Like, there's several Indigenous governments that would be really important. I think Ray will speak to some of that after me, and also kind of your non-traditional things like academic partners like myself that can do kind of an independent science review beyond state agencies. So I think federal, state, municipalities, Indigenous governments all combine at the same table. But I don't know if I'm the right person to speak to the specific folks that should be at the table.
Follow up,
Representative McCabe.
What about the mines?
Absolutely, they play a large role in these processes as through their permitting processes and the monitoring that they already conduct as well.
So, would you advocate that they be at the table as well to sort of, since they're a big part of this issue, of creating the issue, maybe they should be part of the solution as well?
Yes, thank you for the question. I think that's a tricky answer because there's, while they play an important role in collecting data around their project, they also have a conflict of interests in how data are collected. So I think there needs to be a two-pronged approach where there's data collected independent of mining companies, but also that they are part of the conversation in different aspects, if that makes sense.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there further questions for Mr. Sargent from this committee? Representative Christ Hopkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and appreciate seeing you back before the committee. Mr. Sargent, if I recall, you've been in past presentations, and I had to step out, but I was just curious on the slides that I caught after stepping back in vis-a-vis the Taku and the Tulsa chief mine. I think you spoke to need more time to collect data for a longitudinal analysis, need more potentially different data collection points. But I'm wondering, of the data that presently exist, what you're finding and if there's any attributability or cause for water quality or ecological concern based on the data that you have in hand and have been able to analyze. Coming from the Tulsa Chief Mine.
Yes, thank you. Through the chairwoman, thank you, Representative Christ Tompkins, for your question. Yes, the data that have been collected to date are consistent with historical data showing that, you know, directly downstream of the mine for 1 or 2 kilometers or so, you do see a very clear signal in elevated dissolved metals like copper and arsenic, and things like that. There's a very clear signal about the mine. There's still a question, though, in how far downstream that persists and how and what kind of water treatment options should be used to fully remediate the mine. So I think there's still a question is like seasonal patterns. You know, no one is really out in the fall or winter because it's so hard to access, and those could be some of the most toxic times of the water downstream. And so I think a few more years of data and hopefully getting those winter measurements will really help illuminate that. But yes, there's a very clear signal of pollution from the mine that needs to be remediated that's consistent with our data and previously collected.
Follow up, Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you. And in terms of the importance of collecting fall and winter data, the reason that's potentially important is those are lower flow seasons where the proportionality of contaminants are higher, there's potentially or theoretically higher sort of environmental impact in those seasons. Is that the analysis?
That's exactly right. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there further questions? Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Vice Chair Stutz. So a couple questions, since you're a scientist and I'm not. The copper that's found in the stream itself is just, I mean, it's a natural substance. We just disturbed it and it got into the stream where it normally wouldn't, or maybe it would at some point down the line.
Yes, there's depending on the geology of the area, if we take Tulsa Chief Mine as an example, there are natural levels of copper in these rivers. And then when you have a mine where you take rock out of the ground and expose it to oxygen and water, that often will acidify the water, and that lower pH water will dissolve metals like copper and make them more available to organisms that to be uptake in the fish gills, for instance, or their tissue. And so that reaction with acidic water will increase the toxicity of a metal like copper, which has been shown to for salmon to show they can't respond, they can't smell as well. Their nasal passages are hurt by copper, and so they don't do as well at avoiding predators or may even have homing problems back to their waters to spawn again.
Follow up.
Thank you, Vice Chair Stutz. So I'm specifically thinking about the Copper River and some of the finest salmon that ever comes out of Alaska, Copper River Reds, I believe, and we dumped piles of stuff into that river from the Kennecott mine, and yet the salmon are thriving. I get that it's 50 years later or more, actually, but it seems to me that it's the copper's, and you know, if we don't disturb it, eventually it will be disturbed by the course of the river, maybe. I'm also thinking about the Red Dog mine and how we have actually cleaned up some of what was flowing into the river out there and made it a better river for fish. There are actually more fish in the river, so I'm just sort of wondering about the juxtaposition of the whole. You know, you mentioned, when you mentioned copper, you mentioned it like it's a not a natural substance, and yet it is a natural substance. It's just the fact that we disturbed it a little bit more than it would be disturbed eventually, maybe, right?
You know, I think this raises some really good points about, for one, a fish hatchery would never use copper pipes because they know of its toxicity. So there are problems with copper. And the Copper River, I don't have deep knowledge of, but it is quite a large river, and there is dilution that happens. And so I can't speak to the toxicity of the copper in the Copper River in various areas. I'd have to defer that to someone else. What I would say is that what's really important is to learn about these impacts in each individual study system. We can't take a study from one place and extrapolate it all across the land. Fish, especially salmon, are known for their ability to evolve to their specific home water conditions. And while some might be able to resist a little bit of elevated copper because naturally in the watershed, other populations may not do so well. And we see there are very good studies on how copper can be toxic to fish like salmon. So I think it's a very case-by-case specific thing, and this really drives home the point of how well we need to choose where we study these fish, where there could be copper issues, and getting all people at the table to talk about the goals of monitoring these types of substances. And I don't want to focus. Copper was what I brought up, but there are a suite of other metals in mining that they come up that I can't list off the top of my head, but there's a lot. So I hope that gets at your question a little bit.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you. I appreciate Representative McCabe's question. It's gotten at something that I've always wondered at, you know, that there's wide-ranging levels of a lot of variability in water chemistry in a naturally occurring way, or not naturally occurring, I suppose, in the case of the Copper River. I imagine we did a whole lot, you know, 100 years ago that hard to kind of calculate. But if I'm just synthesizing your answer right, Mr. Sargent, that, you know, there's adaptation that naturally occurs with certain rivers that maybe have certain elevated levels of metals. I'm just relating back to a presentation earlier in this committee this year. We were talking about invasive species, and I'm not sure I fully realized that northern pike were naturally occurring in parts of Alaska. And so my question is like, well, why is it a problem in, you know, these introduced watersheds, you know, when salmon and pike seem to coexist elsewhere? And the answer, as I partly recalled, is natural adaptation. And am I synthesizing your answer right, that different salmon runs or other fish species sort of adapt in a sort of bespoke way to the water chemistry of their watersheds, like as a natural baseline? Sorry, that's not as articulate, but I hope you can get where I'm going.
No, it makes sense. Thank you for the question. It's such a hard question to answer because ecologists have not really done the definitive studies. But yes, that's the kind of overriding scientific opinion right now is that salmon are very evolved to their specific waters that they come from. And we should point out that just because something's toxic, it's not that I'm saying that copper makes fish flip over and die, right? I mean, it could in high enough concentrations, but there's sublethal effects to where maybe more are eaten by pike. Let's just put copper and pike together. Maybe more are eaten by pike because they can't sniff them out as well anymore. Okay, so there's these effects where maybe predation's higher. Maybe fish are not homing back to their home river as well. There's just a lot of factors at play, and I think the point I would drive home is that we really need system-specific knowledge for individual rivers. And in some cases, fish, even with living in waters with naturally high levels of metals, they may be at the edge of what they can tolerate, right? And if we just put their foot on their gills and just kind of creep it over that threshold, we're putting those fish in a lot of trouble. And so I think you're synthesizing it correctly, and I hope it, I hope I'm not making it. I'm trying not to be the classic scientist and say more data is needed, but it really is important when it comes to salmon. They're so well evolved to their home waters that we need specific studies for our most important salmon populations.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there further questions? Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Stutz. Through the chair, thank you for being with us today and for your presentation. On one of the pages, and it's not numbered, so I'm not sure the number, but you talk about and list the entities that are conducting monitoring on the Alaska British Transboundary watersheds and have the listing there. And then your project was to identify gaps, and then your conclusion was to have more in more areas monitoring and longer-term data collection. Can you give me an update on when on who is quitting monitoring or just that whole process of what's happening now? I'm just not sure. I'm not following that.
Yes, through the chair, thanks for the question, Rep. Story. I can say that the in the joint Alaska DEC and BC Ministry of Environment report, they've stated that they will not be continuing that monitoring program because it would be redundant with ongoing efforts. I don't believe it's redundant with ongoing efforts, is my personal opinion. And what tends to happen is that Alaska entities tend to monitor in Alaska on our side of the border, and the BC entities tend to monitor on that side of the border, and they're not coordinating the same methods over time. And there's just a lack. They're very concentrated. You know, we have maybe five or six places we're measuring throughout the watershed, and kind of in that map where I showed the Taku, where it's like we want to look at overall watershed health versus specific mining impacts and combining those two sets of points. No one's doing that. No one's doing that right now. And the ongoing Ray will speak to Central Council's efforts. USGS has extensive efforts at the AKBC border with what they call their super gauge that measures stream flow and different water quality attributes like pH and turbidity and things like that. So those are very good efforts. But in the little conclusion, I think it's showing in the slide there, I can't see, but my conclusion remains the same, is that we're working in too small an area of these watersheds for too short a period of time, and we need to expand the things like Central Council and USGS are doing to wider, broader areas throughout the watersheds.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there further questions? Seeing none. Thank you, Mr. Sargent. We appreciate you taking your time to testify before this committee today.
Thank you.
And with that, we will go to Raymond Paddock, who is the Environmental Coordinator for the Central Council Tlingit and Haida. Good morning.
Oh. Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, House Committee. I appreciate your giving me the opportunity to be on this platform. And thank you to Chris and Brianna for their earlier presentations and touching on some of the subjects that I'll be going through here shortly. Again, my name is Raymond Paddock. I'm the Environmental Coordinator for the Central Council Tlingit and Haida. And I am working with a team here at the tribe that's been monitoring on several of the rivers that have been mentioned, the Taku, the Stikine, and we're actually looking to hope to add the Unic with the USGS and, shortly, hopefully this summer. But we're also sampling as well on the Alsek River outside of Yakutat and the Chilkat and Klehini outside of Klukwan and Haines. Just to kind of give a brief example of what we've been doing, and Chris mentioned some of the stuff that they are doing, and I just wanted to touch briefly on what we've done. We sampled in two spots on each river, and as Chris mentioned, you know, a lot of that sampling is still, it's just not enough, but we are fortunate enough to be able to sample in two locations on each river. And these samples are taken on the surface level at a 5-foot depth and another one at a 5-foot depth. And of course, we're measuring our physical parameters with a YSI meter and turbidity meter. Chris touched on some of the metals that are sampled, and we sample for several of those, too many to name, but I'd be happy to share that with you upon request. Many dissolved metals, as well as, of course, the pH, the conductivity, the salinity, dissolved oxygen temperature, and whatnot. I also want to put out there, too, I am not a scientist, so there are some questions I will not be able to answer. I'd be happy to leave that for my team that does that, but for now, I could just give an idea of what we're doing. So, again, for the past 5-6 years or so, we have been sampling on these baseline water quality data on the head rivers, the several transboundary rivers in Southeast. This data was not included in the recent released joint data report that the state of Alaska and BC sent out, though. Klinken High is advocating for federal government appropriation to complete a comprehensive baseline study of the transboundary water ecosystems and water basins, along with key indicators to identify pollutants from mining projects in BC that are on the headwaters of our rivers. Again, while the data report and work of the bilateral working group is a step forward to ensure the environmental, cultural, and economic values of our rivers and communities are protected, Klinken and Haida has not been engaged with the Alaska BC bilateral working group or its technical working group on monitoring since 2018 during the Walker administration, which diminishes the collaborative effort described in the data report. Our way of life depends upon our health of the transboundary waters, and it's important for Alaska tribes and BC First Nations to be fully engaged for true collaboration to exist. This data should not be viewed as a final report, but essentially as the beginning. We feel it was a gross underestimation to the impact of our waters by saying water sampling on these rivers are complete, and we hope to continue to be able, through federal appropriation, to conduct a much broader scale of sampling on each of our rivers that pose a threat. I'm sorry, each of our rivers in Southeast Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Paddock. Appreciate your presentation. Any questions for our presenter? Representative McCabe and then Chris Tompkins.
Thank you, Mr. Paddock. I would be interested if you could forward the list of the metals that you sample for, and hopefully you have the concentrations as well, and maybe even an idea of I'm sure it's wildly different for every river, but maybe you have a baseline that came with it. I know it's hard to have a baseline from before the mine started, but I'm sure we could maybe, I don't know. And also, I think some of the, there are some concentration levels that are published by the U.S. government, and such is too high concentration. Maybe you just have that. If not, I can find it. But
yeah, thank you, Mr. McCabe. We will be putting, just to give you a heads up, and I'll be happy to share the data, but we will be making that data public, and we've been waiting to do so until we came to a certain number that we thought that would be beneficial to give out. And like I said, we've been monitoring for about 5-6 years, and we recently just hit about 35 and 38 samples on the Taku and the Stikeen. As mentioned by Chris earlier, getting to several of the sample sites in the winter, especially since it's not on the road system, is extremely difficult and hazardous. So we missed some of those winter and fall samplings, of course, but we recently just got our 30-plus sampling done on the Taku and Stikeen, and we hope to have that generated in a data report given out to the public shortly. With that said, I'd be happy to share again.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative McCabe. Representative Chris Tompkins.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Paddock. I was wondering, would you be able to say a little bit more about the likelihood of USGS coming in as a partner with funding to commence monitoring on the UNIC?
Well, actually, I think the likelihood is, I won't say definitive, but it's definitely in the process of being worked on right now. We've sent our sampling schedules that we created, my team and I, to the USGS to try and correlate when they're sampling, so we can do it in a partnership level. That also, I wanted to put out there too, that it won't be just us. It will be the Ketchikan Indian community, and as the UNIC River is their home grounds, their homelands. And I also want to put out there that in the process of us sampling on each of these rivers that are not in the Juneau area, but of course the Wrangell area. We work with the partnering tribes to build their capacity up to be able to sample. And so as many of you guys have had this issue before, or this issue with COVID, with travel restrictions, we were in the same boat, not being able to travel, but we were, because of the capacity that we developed with each of the tribes, they were able to go out and sample in their traditional area and send us back the data.
Any follow-up?
No, thank you. That's very helpful.
Any other questions? I had a question, Mr. Paddock. You mentioned that since 2018, Tlingit Haida hasn't been involved in the working group, the bilateral working group. And so it sounds like under Governor Walker's administration, you had been involved. And then when the Dunleavy administration came in, I know there was some transition during that time. But then we've also had federal transition. Is that something that the state could change? So, you know, would, if we were interested, you know, we could say to Governor Dunleavy, you know, please start working with the tribes again, you know, to address this issue. How did that all come about?
Well, I'm not entirely sure how it came about, but it was during the transition area. But yes, we do feel that tribes should be at that table. It was a question was asked earlier about who should be sitting there, and Mr. Sargent mentioned, you know, tribes, but he's not sure of everyone else. But I can safely say that the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida has requested a seat at the table, and as I do believe other tribes in Southeast Alaska and First Nations have as well. I believe Tiz might be able to answer some of that, as she's been advocating on that side to essentially push for that.
Thank you.
You bet.
Any other comments or questions? Okay, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Appreciate your presentation. Then we will next go to Tiz Peterman, a special project court consultant, Southeast Alaska Indigenous Transboundary Commission.
Good morning. My name's Tiz Peterman. As you said, I'm special projects court consultant for the Southeast Alaska Indigenous Transboundary Commission, also known as SEITC. The commission consists of representatives by resolution of 15 federally recognized tribal governments in Southeast Alaska. So I was born and lived my entire life here in Wrangell at the mouth of the Stikine River. I'm here to give you an update on our activities, and I only think it's been the second time I testified on it. So I'm pleased to be here. Basically, I'll start with our correspondence with the BC government. On March 31st of this year, SEITC sent a letter to Premier John Horgan of British Columbia. This brought to his attention SEITC's earlier request to enter into an agreement regarding the participation in ongoing permitting discussions and decisions throughout BC's environmental process pursuant to the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. The earlier request was sent to the Ministry of Energy, Mines, and Low Carbon Innovation, to which they replied that the ministries needed time to conduct comprehensive internal reviews in order to fully respond to our request. Our request of Premier Horgan was a new request from SEITC to have a pause in new permits and approval of new mining projects in BC until such time as the completion of the aforementioned comprehensive internal reviews. That latest request was received, and the ministry will respond at the earliest opportunity. Back in December 6, 2019, SEITC submitted a petition to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, which basically stated that the transboundary mining will have devastating effects on our way of life and downstream communities. That petition at first was rejected based on BC stating it was unaware of downstream concerns. And we actually appealed on the account of numerous letters, maps, and emails to the BC government that SEITC has sent since 2017. This past week, we heard on the back on the appeal, and the Human Rights Commission has forwarded parts of the petition onto the Canadian government, who will then be given a period of 3 months for them to submit its observations on the petition. And back in 2019, SEITC hosted the second of our international summits between First Nations and tribes. A salmon emergency was declared by all 34 participants at the event. Building on that summit will be a third summit in 2020, most likely a virtual one, with the goal of building on the relationships between First Nations and tribes to build a framework on watershed management, which will address free, prior, and informed consent by Indigenous people. For the first time, tribes from Washington, Montana, and Idaho are interested in joining us for the next summit, since they're fighting the same types of issues on their transboundary borders. And prior to COVID-19, SEITC interviewed a host of First Nations during several trips to BC. And culminating from that work, these interviews were developed into a production called When the Salmon Spoke. This virtual production aired online on May 2020 and actually put faces of the people who live on the Stikine River. Over 1,000 people viewed the premiere production. The surprising factor to me when I became involved in the interviews, interviewing the First Nations people, was the fact that we had more in common with our Indigenous brothers and sisters than I thought previously. Another thing we've been involved in, which was an outcome of our When the Salmon Spoke production, was planning a gathering in Wrangell between the Tallapan and the Tlingit. Historically, the Stikine watershed was managed by these two nations. A meeting will be attended by descendants of the Chief Nanak of the Tallapan and descendants of Chief Sheikhs of the Tlingit. This type of meeting has not been held in over 100 years. And since all three transboundary rivers originate in Tallapan territory, it's imperative to keep the channels of communication open. And that's about all I have on SEITC's updates. Thank you for your time today. I agree with Ray Paddock that Indigenous people need to be sitting at this the table whenever transboundary issues are discussed. And I'll be happy to answer any questions. And if not, there's a one-minute trailer of When the Salmon Spoke for your viewing.
Thank you so much, Ms. Peterman. Really appreciate you sharing about your work and the update this morning. Do we have any questions from committee members? Okay, I did have a question. When you talked about the upcoming event, it sounds like the third gathering, who will participants be? And I'm just, and the reason I'm asking this is just trying to understand, it sounds like what's happening now is there's the bilateral working group, which has the sort of traditional government entities participating, but then because it's such a significant need, organizations like yours are also, you know, working with tribal entities to coordinate, but then maybe the two need to be connected.
I think that would be most effective. We've reached out to the First Nations to find out, just for our own information, how the people felt on the other side of the border about the transboundary issues. Because as we all well know, when you listen to the mining company, everything is perfect. But we were hearing quite differently from the people on the ground in BC. Usually at these summits, we bring in all our tribal reps, as many as we can possibly bring. 34 attended the last one. I'd say it was about half and half with leaders from First Nations and our SEITC membership.
Thank you. That's helpful, and appreciate that that work is happening outside of the bilateral working group because it's so important, but that definitely getting the message of, you know, all the voices needing to be at that table.
And we've actually been in meetings with the International Joint Commission when they came to Wrangell and when we went to D.C. And we've been briefing with the State Department prior to, as part of a group, prior to their bilateral meetings.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, then we will play the video. Thank you.
Our story is handed down to us. We talk about the salmon as our relative before man.
What I would like to say, the people that who's going to be impacted by all these mines and stuff, that they have the say. It's not the government's land, it's our land. It always was our land.
We are very connected to the salmon, and like the salmon, we face some difficult choices, and we need to be talking with one mind, one spirit, for the good of our people.
Let me tell you about the Stikine River.
Well, thank you for sharing that trailer with us. And I guess I should ask if people wanted to see the entire production, Ms. Peterman, is that available?
If we still have absolutely. We can get you the links to that after this meeting.
Okay, thank you so much. If you share that with us, we'll share with committee members. And I'd love to be able to watch that and learn. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Okay, our last invited presenter today is Francis Leach, the Executive Director of United Fishermen of Alaska. Welcome.
Welcome. Good morning, Chairwoman Tarr, apologies, and members of the House Fisheries Committee. For the record, my name is Francis Leach, and I am the Executive Director of United Fishermen of Alaska. The organization I represent, United Fishermen of Alaska, also known as UFA, is the statewide commercial fishing trade association. We represent 37 commercial fishing organizations around the state, as well as over 500 individuals that participate in fisheries throughout the state and federal waters off of our coast. UFA works to promote and protect the common interests of Alaska's commercial fishing industry, as well as vital components of Alaska's social and economic well-being. 11 of UFA's 37 member groups represent commercial fishermen who fish shrimp, crab, salmon, and other species in the waters of Southeast Alaska. Southeast Alaska fishermen are employed by hand trawl, power trawl, drift net, purse seine, long line pots, and even dive gear to harvest their catches in Southeast Alaska. UFA is increasingly concerned with the potential impacts to fish habitat and water resources from at least 12 large-scale open pit and underground metal mines in British Columbia that are abandoned, permitted, or operating in the headwaters of transboundary rivers that flow downstream into Southeast Alaska. Some of these rival the size of the Pebble Mine in Bristol Bay. I'd like to take a moment to say that United Fishermen Alaska is not opposed to mining, but we are for responsible mining that has held strict scientific standards, just as the commercial fishing industry is monitored for sustainability and protection of the resources. The transboundary Taku, Stikine, Askut, and Unaknas are world-class salmon-producing rivers, contributing $48 million to the Alaska economy, and producing 80% of Southeast Alaska's king salmon. The health and productivity of these rivers is integral to the overall 1 billion annual sales in salmon, 1 billion annual salmon fishing industry and the 1 billion annual visitors industry in Southeast Alaska. In 1957, Teck Resources abandoned the Tulsa-Quechief mine in the Taku River watershed, which is just 33.5 miles, or 55 as the salmon swims from our capital city of Juneau, where we are today. The damage caused by the abandoned Tulsa-Quechief mine had a direct impact on the wild salmon that inhabited this river. Commercial fishermen and our community have been up in arms about this project for more than 60 years. And because of BC's laws, this mine site has been leaching acid mine drainage into our largest salmon river in southeast Alaska for 60 years. This year, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game will list the Takus, Dakin, and Nunik king salmon runs as stocks of concern. We are continuing to see the impacts and devastation. The best way to avoid lost livelihoods and cultural ways of life is for them not to be lost in the first place. UFA has been engaged on this matter and has written several letters to the state of Alaska and our congressional delegation over the past several years. However, in recent years, we have seen a diminished response to this subject from the state of Alaska. Now is not the time to be putting transboundary issues on the back burner. We are asking the state of Alaska to please join the Alaska Congressional Delegation and call for federal engagement and international binding protections. Please engage on this important issue that will affect not just commercial fishermen, but all of Southeast Alaska and Alaskans. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Leach. Appreciate your testimony this morning. Do we have any questions for our presenter? Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Chair Tarr. So, Ms. Leach, I'm wondering if UFA has thought this through to its logical end. So if we put, as regulators, lawmakers, put huge restrictions on the mines that make the copper ore or the steel ore, iron ore, or coal, or any of those things that would leak into the rivers, and thus the price of the base metal goes up, and now the price of the boats goes astronomically high, that your members use to catch fish, is that going to be an issue? So now I think then the price of our fish goes up. So there has to be a balance, I think, is my point. And it seems like we've heard from a whole bunch of fish people here today. I'm concerned that there's no balance in this hearing today. And there's really no balance. I would expect that UFA would have some idea of the end game, what happens if we price the mines completely out and we end up getting all our metals and all of our copper from China or across the pond. I just am a little concerned that maybe we have blinders on and we're not thinking it through to its logical conclusion. It's much the same as the renewable resources, wind turbines, solar panels, all of the metal, all of the raw material that we use to build those comes from mining. We have to have a balance. As my point earlier is, the mines need to be part of the voice. Well, they need to know that we're going to hold them accountable, but we need to understand their needs as well, or we're not going to be able to. Fishing boats will be priced out of astronomically high unless we go back to sailboats. I guess it's more of a comment than a question.
Through the chair, I would like to respond to that if possible.
Sure, go ahead.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative McCabe, point taken. UFA has actually worked very closely with the Alaska Mining Association, also known as AMA, and we do have a fairly good relationship and always invite them to have conversations and have a seat at the table. Additionally, I do know that AMA has had the ability to give presentations to the Alaska legislature, just as we are today. You are only hearing from fish-focused people because that is what today's presentation is about, obviously. Additionally, your comment about boat prices going up if mines are shut down, we're not asking for mines to be shut down. We're asking for mines to be responsible. And also, if they're not responsible, then there won't be fish, and then we won't have a need for boats. So I think that, you know, there definitely is a balance. There's definitely room at the table for everyone to have this open discussion. But right now, there's really nothing that's facilitating this discussion, which is why we're here asking for this. Thank you.
Follow up. So through the chair, if that's all right. Sorry.
No, that's okay. Go ahead.
Kind of a free form discussion here, and I appreciate it. So I really appreciate it. I appreciate that you are involved with AMA. We all, I'm a pro-development guy, but I'm a pro-fisheries development as well. And I'm more than that, I am an advocate that we are all good stewards of our environment. Coming from a Coast Guard background in Kodiak, I've seen lots of environmental problems come from fishing boats, as I'm sure Vice Chair Stutes has, just by virtue of her background. It's too easy to pump your bilge somewhere and not clean it up, and just like it's too easy to build a crappy tailings pond dam. So we collectively, and this is way more than the Fisheries Committee, but we collectively need to be better stewards of our environment. Fishermen, mining, and we all need a seat at the table. And so I appreciate that you and AMA are involved together, because I think it's important.
Thank you, Representative McCabe. And yeah, I appreciate those comments as well. And yeah, it's interesting thinking about sort of what was presented with abandoned versus permitting and operating. And, you know, certainly one thing is that in the case of the abandoned mines, there are lessons to be learned and mistakes to not be repeated. And so, you know, hopefully we can find a way to get all the sort of right people at the table. I mean, it sounds like more than anything, you know, what's kind of missing here is a lot of coordination, because there's work happening, but, you know, some of the people doing the work aren't involved in, you know, some of those conversations. So is our role as the Fisheries Committee, and Representative Ortiz might be working on something we had discussed before committee, you know, should we consider writing a letter, or is there, you know, something we can do on this issue to encourage, you know, that coordination and making sure that all those voices are included? And I'm sure, you know, at that level with the working group would also involve, you know, folks from the mining industry, right, that, you know, either represent companies or just the industry more broadly. So I think, though, that Representative Ortiz might be working on something related to that. So I'll just put that out there, and we'll follow up with committee members. But I think, you know, when we consider sort of what's our role as the Fisheries Committee on this topic, you know, it does seem like the message that I'm getting from today is just better coordination and definitely tribal involvement in those government-to-government discussions, you know, so that things, there's a better plan in place. So that's my big takeaway. I don't know, Ms. Leach, if you have any other comments, you know, or any response to my comment, but want to give you that opportunity.
Thank you, Chairwoman. I don't have anything else to add, but thank you so much for listening to everyone today. And I don't know if Bree has any closing comments or not.
Bree, if you're available, if you have any closing comments.
Thank you, Chairwoman Tarr. I think you summarized things quite well, and I just wanted to say again, as we're seeing these wild salmon populations dropping dramatically in the Taku, Stikine, and Yunik, it's imperative that we all work together to develop binding international watershed scale framework that will protect the health of these significant salmon watersheds and the communities who depend on them. As you've heard today through multiple presentations, there are multiple jurisdictions that are linked to these iconic salmon rivers, including and especially the indigenous nations of this region, as well as the state of Alaska, the province of British Columbia, the United States, and Canadian federal governments, and the communities on both sides of the border. All of these jurisdictions need to play a role in the development and implementation of binding measures for these watersheds. That is all that I have to say. I will just reference that there, I would just like to say thank you to all of you for today, and especially to those of you who have and continue to do so. I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you, and it's really good to get the update, because what keeps happening is the people in these chairs change, and the people in the governor's office change, the people, right, we've just had a federal change, the premiers have changed in British Columbia, so definitely a reminder of why that coordination is so important, so that as the people change, that the effort can continue, you know, and the progress can continue. So thank you so much for your presentation, and we'll look forward to continuing that discussion and learning more as we go forward. If there's nothing else to come before our committee today, on Thursday, we did have House Bill 182, but we have discharged with that. So we are done with that. And we do have another bill coming up. So this will be House Bill 52, the Tutka Bay Hatchery. This is Representative Vance's bill. So that's our first hearing. And then we'll have Ms. Leach back to give us an update on commercial fishing industry in Alaska and impact of COVID-19 to the industry. There have been a lot of funding streams come through and just different things try to get everybody up to date on where things are today. Okay, if no other business is to come before the committee, we will adjourn at 11:45 a.m.